We're honored to have two local scientists. We are so fortunate in the San Antonio community to have Dr. Perry and Dr. Donald Royal with us tonight to share the latest in research and treatment options and to offer their insights on what you can do for yourself and for your loved ones afflicted with Alzheimer's. We all know that as of today, there is no cure, but I am convinced that by equipping ourselves with knowledge, we are in a better position to deal with that diagnosis when it comes to ourselves or to a loved one. Dr. George Perry, in addition to being one of our newest board members, is a neuroscientist and dean of the College of Sciences and professor of biology at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Go Roadrunners. He's recognized in the field of Alzheimer's disease research and particularly for his work on oxidative stress. He studied at the Hopkins Marine Station of Stanford University and the Marine Biological Laboratory of Woods Hole and obtained his PhD in marine biology in 1979. He did a postdoc fellowship in the Department of Cell Biology at Baylor College of Medicine, where he laid the foundation for his observations of cytoskeletal abnormalities. He is distinguished as one of the top Alzheimer's disease researchers with over 900 publications and is one of the top 100 most cited scientists in neuroscience and behavior and one of the top 25 scientists in free radical research. In his spare time, he is editor for numerous journals and is editor-in-chief for the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences and a past president of the American Association of Neuropathologists. Donald Royal, MD, is a psychiatrist with multiple appointments at UTH, I always want to say UTESCA's, Department of Psychiatry. He's director of research for the Freedom House Foundation and is faculty and staff physician for the Audie Murphy VA Geriatric Research Education and Clinical Care Program right here in San Antonio. He did his undergraduate work at Texas A&M, go Aggies, and received his medical degree from UT Health Science Center in Houston. He was a resident in both internal medicine and psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University and is trained in clinical and translational geriatric research. He became interested in the executive functions of the brain while observing schizophrenics during his psychiatry residency at Johns Hopkins. His special interests include geriatric assessment, the cognitive correlates of functional outcomes, executive function, and dementing illnesses. He has developed practical bedside tests for healthcare professionals to determine executive function impairment and to distinguish Alzheimer's from other ailments. These tests allow physicians and other healthcare providers to determine a patient's executive function in as little as 20 minutes. And it is my pleasure. We're going to do things a little bit differently tonight, as Catherine said, in the spirit of experimentation. Dr. Perry's going to speak first, and then Dr. Royal will speak following. Dr. Perry?
Thank you. It's really quite an honor to speak here. Coming to these talks ever since I joined the faculty at UTSA to find out that not only did they have a great university in San Antonio, they had an incredible venue that brings science to the public and a format I think that many of you appreciate and probably responsible for why we're increasing the number of members. And to talk about Alzheimer's disease, I think, puts a central point of where the Mind Science Foundation is, and that is understanding consciousness and cognition and its loss as we age, at least for some of us as we age. I like to begin the talk by asking a question. How many of you are here concerned about having an Alzheimer's disease, either yourself or a close family member? And there was a recent survey of this and compiled, it was published in Time magazine, but it's been shown at many other venues, that in fact about 85% of the population is very, very concerned about having Alzheimer's disease during their lifetime or a close family member. But in fact, the risk of Alzheimer's disease is less than 30%. So that means that people have a 3 times bigger concern about developing the disease than the real reality of developing it. And you might say, well, everybody's hypochondriac. But if you look at other conditions, heart disease, cancer, it's actually the reverse. These are common diseases, and people are less concerned. Your chance may be 50 or 60% of developing those during your lifetime, but your concern might be 15%. And why is there this detachment? I think we could talk about, as I'll talk about later, about the economics and the social impact, but I think one of the major concerns about loss of control of your consciousness, about a loss of the mind-body connection that is so much at the center of the Mind Science Foundation and defines us as humans. So Alzheimer's disease is a common disease, and I'll show more of the statistics of that. Even if your chance is only 30% to experience it, it's still one. It's the most common form of dementia. And it robs individuals of their identity. If people develop the disease and it progresses, which is usually an inexorable progressive disease, the last 8 to 10 years, the individual will lose all identity and consciousness. And in fact, their body will lose functions just because of that lack of consciousness. But it's very disturbing when you have a family member who right before you is losing consciousness and has their body form with you and often has behavioral issues at the same time. And Dr. Royal will talk about many of the challenges to handling these patients and treating them with dignity and getting the most out of that period of life. The other part about Alzheimer's disease, when I started studying Alzheimer's disease, I was recruited from Baylor College of Medicine to work at Case Western. In fact, no one had heard of Alzheimer's disease. I was hired for this job, and I said, I'm going to study the Alzheimer's disease. And my colleagues that were fellow postdocs in me said, what is that? So we had to look in an encyclopedia, so to speak, to find out what it was. So why is this such a big issue now in the last 40 years that wasn't even known? This disease has been described since 1906. Why now is it such an issue? Is it because more people are living longer? Is the disease increasing? Is it because it's such a huge social and economic impact? The current indications are that people are spending about $200 billion a year on care of people with Alzheimer's disease, and probably an equivalent amount uncompensated care. Estimates are about 15 million hours of uncompensated care is being given by family members. This drains both families, both financially, as I mentioned, maybe $400 billion impact, but emotionally, taking care of your loved one and seeing them before your eyes lose consciousness and may even have problems of you relating to them as they develop many of the side effects, such as aggression, wandering, etc. Also, is the disease increasing? The latest estimates are it's one of the few age-related diseases that were really not dealt with very well. In the last 8 years, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is increased by 66%. While other diseases of the aged, well, many of these are of the aged except for HIV, in fact, are slightly decreasing. Alzheimer's disease is still increasing, and probably for a couple reasons. One is that it's an age-related disease, as I'll show later, and while the old idea that 100 years ago everybody died at 30 is not correct, people, the 30 of 100 years ago was a blend of 70 and 0. Many children die during infancy, and a majority of people who live to adults live to the 60s and 70s. The fastest growing part of our population of those over 85. And that's where the highest risk of Alzheimer's disease is. The other part is in 1906, Allo's Alzheimer's described a woman, a middle-aged woman, August Dieter. And she was in her 50s. She had profound paranoia, jealousy, and loss of cognitive function. She was institutionalized because of this. And Alzheimer described her brain. And that's very often the way medicine progresses, a single case, a case study. And August Dieu is shown on the right. In this case, looks pretty out of it, even though she was only in her 50s at the time of this photo. When her brain was examined, it showed a characteristic type pathology. But what really made Alzheimer's discovery possible wasn't just August D having the right patient in that single case. It was two important insights. One, technological, histological stains based on silver, which were able to show the pathology of the disease. The Germans during this period, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, developed an array of stains to show abnormalities in the body. But even more so, Emil Kraepelin, which name should be familiar to most psychiatrists in this audience, who is credited as being the founder of modern psychiatry, he believed that when there were abnormalities in the mind, there had to be abnormalities in the body. So he adapted neuropathology to studying brain disorders. And in Europe, the way neuropathologists and psychiatrists and neurologists were trained, they were all one person. So the person dealt with the patient when they were living, dealt with the patient after death, and analyzed what the abnormalities was. So that was a key part in being able to bring together the the body and the mind changes of August D. But unfortunately, August D was a young individual, and the description of Alzheimer's disease therefore was left to a disease of young individuals until actually later. And that was the work of Tomlinson and Roth in the 1970s. And that's why Alzheimer's disease wasn't appreciated as being a common disease. What they did is they studied a large group of patients systematically, people that were institutionalized, that were both cognitively normal as well as demented. And what they found was that there was a profound difference in the brain between those people who were demented versus the normal people that also died. And these were people in the age group of 70 to 80, if not more. And what they found were these changes. I'll show in the next slide, the plaques and tangles and the profound atrophy, shrinkage of the brain. But why is it important that we were able to take Alzheimer's disease from a disease of a 50-year-old woman or individual to a disease that affects people in their 70s and 80s? The reason is it's a tremendous big step in terms of public health. Very few people have Alzheimer's disease when they're in their 50s. But if you look at people that here, we're looking at the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease in various age groups. And you can see in age 65 to 74, only a few percent of the population has Alzheimer's disease. As where over the age of 85, you can see that it varies up to over half the population. It's important to note that there is a clear effect of ethnicity on these incidents, highly relevant for San Antonio. Those people of Hispanic heritage actually have a much higher incidence. And this particular study performed in New York City, 62% of those over age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. Now, more studies are clearly necessary to understand what this difference is. It's likely to be not completely genetic. It's likely to be lifestyle related. Now, what did Alzheimer find and Tomlinson and Blessin and Roth in the 1970s? They found a clear change in the brain of people with Alzheimer's disease, dramatized here when you look through a section of the brain. A healthy brain as you've seen in previous Mind Science Talks, fills the cranium and has the surrounding gray matter and white matter filling up most of the cavity. People with advanced Alzheimer's disease lose about one-third of the brain mass, and the brain shrinks up. The head doesn't shrink up, so it's filled with a lot of fluid, and the middle part of the brain, the ventricles, actually become larger. The most striking part of this atrophy involves the hippocampus, the part at the bottom of the brain that's shown here, which can have up to a 90% loss. And that's the part of the brain associated with memory. And it's why people with Alzheimer's disease have profound memory loss as one of the earliest symptoms. And later on, they would have shrinkage throughout the cortex. The other part that was described by Alzheimer's and is what the disease is defined as having is a pathology of the brain, both quote-unquote tangles and plaques. And they marked here the plaque is the amyloid deposits, which are cellularly complex, and the tangles are inside of neurons that are at risk of death. The other part that comes with these neurons die. You can find up to 90% loss in some regions of the brain, and dead neurons don't function well, so you have loss of functionality where they occur. But one of the major focuses since the mid-80s in Alzheimer's disease research has been the idea that if we took these pathological changes out of the brain, people would benefit. So the primary focus over this period of the last 15 to 20 years has been an approach to try to remove the pathology of the disease. And modern medicine's been incredibly successful at doing so. The most effective agent in this regard has been a vaccine. There's been various titles used to describe these interventions. The most recent and most comprehensive is a bapineuzumab trial of thousands of patients. And the patients, as well as this trial, as well as many others that have been attempted, the amyloid has been removed, but in fact the patients did worse. So it leads us to wonder whether this approach will be useful. Great. Useful intervention tool. And that's because we've taken, in our own studies, a slightly different approach. And that is because when we did studies on the pathology of the disease, we in fact found that tangles and plaques are associated actually with regeneration of the brain, that the proteins making them played a role in regulating things such as oxidative stress. And this led us to actually go back and look where Alzheimer was in the beginning and Thomas and Roth. The idea that Alzheimer's disease is a disease of aging and very linked to the aging process. Prior to the age of 60, those people that develop the disease usually have a profound genetic issue. And which puts them out of the normal evolutionary process. So we came to this idea that maybe the amyloid and the plaques may be failed responses of the brain to try to repair itself, and therefore attempts to try to reverse the amyloid by removing it may make people worse. And that's what has been found so far. So our approach is to use what we know is happening in the brain, looking at the window through oxidative stress. That is the reason many of you probably take vitamin E and vitamin C is because you think this will keep you from rusting away. So the simple idea is that you're here and the oxygen is actually a toxin that you're using, combining with your body to be able to have you move. But you need to be able to control this very, very carefully. And that's what antioxidants do, vitamin E and vitamin C. The downside of that is, as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease, they have been used and they weren't effective, because just as the amyloid, oxidative stress is a more complex phenomena than something that needs to be stopped. It's also an essential part of the life processes, and taking large amounts of vitamins can actually unbalance that. So we've actually been looking at the issue of trying to look at how would we modify oxidative stress, working together with some groups that have looked at modifying metal metabolism, copper and iron, not aluminum, in the body. The other part that we've been looking at is indications from what we're seeing between the Hispanic population versus the Caucasian population, or different lifestyles. There's been a tremendous amount of evidence coming from the Barshop Center in San Antonio and other places suggesting that the aging process is not only tied to things like oxidative stress, but also tied to how we regulate metabolism, such as insulin and diabetes regulation. And we think it's really important to understand this, to be able to have an intervention. The fact that Hispanics have 2 times more Alzheimer's disease, as shown by the study in New York, and has been shown pretty consistently in other studies, probably indicates this linkage between type 2 diabetes and Alzheimer's disease and metabolic insufficiency. And that should be a correctable issue. The other part that we've been looking at is understanding whether the aging process itself, whether in fact it may be good to have wrinkling of the skin as we get old, or to have other changes that are part of the aging processes that are identified as being deleterious, that may be important protective responses of the body to keep us alive. In other words, reversing the order of things. Instead of thinking about why people get demented at 90, why not think of the opposite? How is it that people live to 90 or 100 and maintain normal cognition? How does the brain respond and maintain this when it has only limited renewal? The neurons you have in your brain when you're 90 were made when you were a child and have very little turnover. How do they maintain normalcy? And people that are 90 years old and normal have tremendous amounts of amyloid and tangles in their brain. There's a tremendous amount of overlap. And further, to reemphasize, lifestyle modification has substantial benefit for patients. Being mentally engaged, attending the Mind Science Foundation lectures, being a donor to the Mind Science Foundation. All of those, and you know, being physical exercise, eating a well-balanced diet. Some indications just in this last week is that sugar causes your brain to shrink. I don't know if it's so clear as that, but certainly living a life of moderation is important. And moderation can include drinking wine. So where do we go from here? Being an Alzheimer's researcher myself, I have to say more funding would help. You know, there's been tremendous benefit for AIDS patients. There's about 50 times more money spent for AIDS research per patient than for Alzheimer's research. And you know, AIDS has been changed in the developed world from a death sentence to a chronic condition that can be managed. Alzheimer's disease, we have treatments, but they're not particularly effective. Improve care for patients, understanding that people with Alzheimer's disease can live in the community and can be managed. Dr. Royal will talk more about this. Just changing the environment in which people live in. People have Alzheimer's disease, lose visual acuity. If you can deal with that, you can get, they can live more freely. Or understanding how to deal with patients that wander or have depressive symptoms. Improved diagnosis is certainly one of the major areas that people have made headway. You can now image the brain to know those people that have high levels of amyloid in their brain. We've known for years that people that develop Alzheimer's disease have a change in metabolism. That's one of the reasons why we looked at oxidative stress prior to the developing the disease. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of treatments that make any difference after the people know you know they're at higher risk, because I would give you the same advice no matter what that treatment outcome. But certainly imaging, biomarkers, better neuropsychological testing, epidemiological studies, we're defining the disease better. I think one of the big headways will be made when we try to focus more on trying to work with the biology of the disease work on understanding its relationship to aging, we're going to be able to make greater headway to go forward. So thank you very much.
Well, good to be here. I thank the Mind Science Foundation for the invitation to speak to you all today. And I thought what I would do is come and tell you some about how I'm thinking about Alzheimer's disease these days, and that'll give you an overview to some of the research that we're doing. And, you know, I would start this by saying that everybody's afraid of Alzheimer's, but I really would like to get across to you that we should at least respect it, because it's a very amazing and challenging problem, both from the perspective of aging and its relationship to Alzheimer's disease and how the disease actually works, and with regard to how difficult it's proven to try to come up with effective treatments for it. And it all starts with this guy, Alzheimer, who was in the right place in the right time in Germany at the early part of the 20th century, where they were starting to develop new stains that allowed them under the microscope to look at the pathology of people, and he described these lesions, the amyloid plaque and the neurofibrillary tangle, which are the hallmark pathological features that help define the disease. Now, many non-demented persons have these lesions in them, so the presence of the pathology itself does not predict a demented state. And of these two lesions, the amyloid plaque is more weakly related to cognition than the tangle. The tangle is more strongly related to cognitive impairment, but most of our treatment interventions and a lot of our research has been directed against the amyloid plaque, I think because the light's better. But basically, it's the weaker of the two correlates of cognition. And actually, there are other pathological changes in Alzheimer's disease that he didn't describe that correlate even better with cognition, like synaptic density is probably the strongest pathological correlate of cognitive impairment that we know of. One of the amazing things about Alzheimer's, and something I think that's not widely appreciated, is that the tangle here, these are tangle pathology, progresses stepwise through the brain, following the wiring of the different brain regions. So this is an autopsy series from France. Every column here is an individual autopsy case, and every row is a different part of the brain. And the blue areas here are showing the areas that are affected by tangles. So you can see, literally, the stepwise progression, region by region, backwards into the brain, and at some point, dementia happens. And I've shaded those in red for you to see. So what you need to appreciate is that everything we think of as mild, moderate, and severe dementia in Alzheimer's is really the middle to the end of the disease, a disease that spans decades. The average age of onset of Alzheimer's lesions anywhere in the brain can be estimated to be as young as 48, meaning that 50% of the population may have tangles in their brain by age 50. And by the age of, say, 70, there's almost 100% penetrance, whether you're demented or not. So even though the statistics tell you that Alzheimer's disease goes higher with age and a relatively small percentage of 60 and 70-year-olds have it, they're really only talking about the clinical tip of the iceberg, because much larger populations have the pathology at some stage in its development. And it looks like the very beginning of Alzheimer's is limited to parts of the brain that are related to your sense of smell. So that clinically, one of the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease is to lose your sense of smell, the recognition of smells. And we use that as a simple bedside screening test. A lot of persons with other dementias retain their ability to smell. So if they've reached the stage of dementia and they can still identify smells, that almost excludes the possibility of it being Alzheimer's, because the only way Alzheimer's could result in dementia would be if it had accomplished all of the previous steps. And so a large part of my job is to try to figure out if this person's disease is following the expected progression, step by step by step, of the evolution of the Alzheimer's pathology through the brain. And what's more amazing is that this is the tangle. The amyloid doesn't work like this. Not only does it not progress stepwise, but it doesn't follow these steps. It seems to originate in other parts of the brain that the tangles take years to invade. And so amyloid can be demonstrated now by imaging in the cortex years before the tangles can be there, because if the tangles were there at that time, the patient would be demented by that. And the amyloid, we know, is there before the dementia starts. So this is actual data from a large study in Hawaii that I worked on, where they had a population-based sample. So this isn't Alzheimer's cases out of a clinic. This is just a statistically random, or at least as good as they could get, study of an entire population in Hawaii of Japanese American men. And this is the... Oops, I lost it there. This is the number of tangles in these different regions of the brain. This is a memory center in the hippocampus. This is one synapse away, one step in the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And what I want to show you is it's kind of like there's an obstacle, a dam here. Hundreds of tangles are present behind the dam, but relatively few are one synapse away. But this structure leads to the rest of the brain. And if the tangles get past that, you're 75% of the way to the end of the disease. So it looks to me like Alzheimer's has a non-linear story. It starts in your 40s in parts of the brain related to smell that you have very little, you pay no attention to that. And it sits there behind this wall for what look like must be decades until another shoe drops. And when that shoe drops, it gets out of the memory centers into the rest of the brain, and you have the beginning of what we recognize and call Alzheimer's disease. And not only that, but the dementia is related statistically to just a few regions right here, this step. 89% of the cases can be correctly classified as demented or not simply by the question, are there tangles in one of those four places? Even if you adjust for tangles everywhere else. So the Alzheimer's symptoms don't necessarily, or at least the dementia, doesn't necessarily arise from the global burden of all these messed up neurons in your brain. But it may be very location specific to a particular part of the brain, and that part has been identified by imaging and is labeled now the default mode network. This is a very interesting part of the brain that you should pay attention to, because it was discovered accidentally because it's the parts of the brain that are active in control groups in studies who are merely told to just lie there and do nothing. As soon as you ask the brain to do something, like who's the president, or what's the day of the week, or you know, a task that we think of as cognitive tests, this part of the brain turns off, and the parts in blue turn on. So the default mode network are the red parts here. And the blue parts are parts of the brain that are activated by specific cognitive tasks. And so what this means is that cognitive screening is relatively disadvantaged at trying to detect who actually has dementia. There are clearly people in the world who fail cognitive tests, but just look at them. They're not demented. And there are other people who are demented, and yet they do pretty well on cognitive tasks. And so no one has been able to operationalize a way to diagnose dementia solely on the basis of cognitive testing. You always need a clinician to kind of provide this fudge factor and get at the progressive disability of the case that defines dementia. And I think that that's a fundamental limitation of the way this works. This critical network in the brain is off whenever you try to attempt to screen someone with cognitive testing. And then it comes back in the interlude between that and the next step in their daily plan. So this key part of the brain here, the default mode network, I'm going to hear its hubs here in red, and I'll just show you that it has been popping up in the literature for years and we didn't realize it. This is before the default mode network was ever described. These are the parts of the brain whose metabolism is reduced when people become demented, and you can see that it's essentially the same regions of the brain. It's the default mode network. That's the posterior cingulate. Here is another study. These are the parts of the brain where one stroke causes dementia. Now, usually it takes a whole bunch of strokes, and somehow in their aggregate, dementia develops. But these are the places where one stroke can cause dementia, and again, it's the default mode network. Do you recognize it? You can see this part here, that's area 39, this part here in the frontal lobe, this part here, it's called the posterior cingulate. So this kind of progression bothers me. I mean, I think it's a very interesting feature of the disease, and it begs the question of whether Alzheimer's might be an infectious process, because infectious agents like viruses and another kind of infectious agent called prions, a prion, which is a protein, are one of the few things I know of that can propagate backwards into the brain following the wiring step by step by step as the Alzheimer's pathology appears to do. And so nobody's been able to prove that Alzheimer's is related to a virus, but a lot of people are trying, and increasingly they're getting traction in the literature. But viruses definitely make their way into your brain following the wiring exactly like this. And not only that, but they're human viruses. Every host-parasite relationship is species-specific. And what this would also help explain is why Alzheimer's pathology doesn't occur spontaneously in old mammals in zoos. Even our relatives like gorillas, when they get old, don't get Alzheimer's disease. And the only exceptions are domesticated animals like sheep, goats, and cows that have been living with us in our homes almost since the advent of agriculture, and therefore long enough for our viruses to learn to jump across species and establish diseases in those animals as well. So I've been thinking of the brain as a castle, and there's only two ways into a castle. You can go in through the walls or in through the gates. But if you go into the walls, who knows where you'll land? And so the diseases that go in randomly into the brain, like stroke or multiple sclerosis, don't have stories. They don't have stages. They don't have a beginning, a middle, or an end, because you throw the dice and then there's another lesion. But if you go in through the gates, then the castle reveals itself to you as a space, step by step by step. And so you can only get from here to there. And that means that the parts of the castle you can invade or experience are linearly oriented in a sequence, and that gives the disease a story. And Alzheimer's is notorious for having a story. It has stages, and they're relatively stereotyped across individual cases, so that you can use that as a clinician to try to help improve your diagnosis. So I think that the story of Alzheimer's is reflecting the propagation of the tangles through the brain. Not so much the amyloid, but the tangles. And that what we're seeing in the clinic is the regions one by one following to the invading tangle as it makes its way through the brain. And so you're pretty familiar with the symptoms of Alzheimer's. Generally, memory impairment is one of the earliest symptoms. But Alzheimer's actually affects smell before memory, and memory is inevitable in Alzheimer's because it's wired into your sense of smell, the hippocampus is. And so to get to the key default mode network, the pathology has to go through the hippocampus, and so inevitably you're going to develop a certain memory impairment. And it's the kind of memory impairment that a hippocampal lesion would result in. It's called amnestic. It's related to short-term memory, not long-term memory. But that's an artifact of where the Alzheimer's started and how it got into the brain. There's no a priori reason why any other dementia would work that way, because they don't necessarily propagate like that, and they don't necessarily start in the olfactory parts of the brain. So basically, there's no a priori reason why memory loss would be inevitable in dementia in general. But it's a key feature of recognizing Alzheimer's disease. And there are a bunch of these nerves where an invading pathogen might get in. There's a rare variant of Alzheimer's. This is the nerve that might be how Alzheimer's gets started. But there's a rare variant of Alzheimer's that affects the visual centers early in the disease, not memory. But at autopsy, it's full of plaques and tangles. It looks just like Alzheimer's, but they're in the wrong place. And there, the first symptom is to go blind, not to lose your memory. And the distribution of the lesions respects the innervation of the second cranial nerve. Then there's hearing loss. This is the eighth cranial nerve. It's related to your sense of hearing. There is a central auditory processing deficit that older people get into where they have trouble hearing, and a hearing aid won't fix it because it's in your brain, not in your ear. And this type of hearing loss has been related to future dementias, but not necessarily Alzheimer's disease. But it's another example of a neural network that whose symptoms may relate to a particular story that leads to dementia in the end. And then there's the 10th cranial nerve out of 12, and this one's called the vagus nerve, and it's increasingly looking like Lewy body disease, which is another dementing illness, may propagate through the vagus nerve and its connections into the brain. So that in the case of Lewy body disease, it may actually start outside the brain in the nervous endpoints here, where the brain is talking to the heart's talking back to the brain, following these nervous connections. Well, Lewy bodies can be demonstrated out here in the periphery before they can be demonstrated in the brain. And cardiac imaging is abnormal in Lewy body patients and is better able to distinguish Lewy body disease from Alzheimer's disease than brain imaging. So imagine that in Lewy body and Parkinson's, which is a closely related disease, there's cardiac abnormalities that demonstrate that the nerves that supply the heart from the brain have degenerated. And that's one of the earliest biomarkers of Lewy body and Parkinson's disease. When the Lewy bodies are in this particular part of the brain, the sinoatrial node, patients develop cardiac arrhythmias. And one of those is called atrial fibrillation, which is fairly common and is a big risk factor for stroke. Atrial fibrillation now is recognized as a predictor of future Parkinson's and Lewy body disease. It's a risk factor for Lewy body and Parkinson's disease in the future. And presumably, the Lewy body story can be related to the pattern of the wiring of these different stages along the way towards the brain eventually. The vagus nerve, though, isn't just wired into the heart. It's wired into multiple organs. It's not going back. There we go. So Lewy body patients are plagued with many other medical disorders, not just atrial fibrillation. In the esophagus, Lewy bodies are, you can find them there, and they lead to acid reflux disease. In the bladder, the Lewy bodies are in the nerves that supply that, and that can lead to what's called detrusor instability, and they have recurrent urinary tract infections from that. It can get into the colon, and so Parkinson's and Lewy body patients have years of constipation prior to the onset of their Parkinson's disease. And so all of these extracranial manifestations of Lewy body may be the opening stages of its story, which can be related to pathology propagating up a different cranial nerve than the one that Alzheimer's normally invades. You should know that the state of Texas is investing now in Alzheimer's research through what's called the Texas Alzheimer's Research Consortium, and our medical school is a site in this consortium. We've recruited just about 2,000 elderly persons throughout the state and are following them longitudinally now to get a sense of what's happening with them. And this is just some of the stuff I've done with TARC data. And I'm trying to get at what exactly is dementia? What do you mean by that? How could we measure it more efficiently? And what dementia is, it's not cognitive impairment. Lots of people have cognitive impairment, fail cognitive testing, and they're not necessarily demented. There's more than that. You have to also be disabled. And then furthermore, the disability has to be related to the cognitive impairment. And so we get really fancy with this. There's going to be a test on this after we get through. But basically, leave it to say that through fancy footwork, we can take a battery of cognitive measures and functional status measures rated by the patient's caregiver, for example, and distill that down to a variable that I call D, which is the fraction of variance in cognitive performance that is in fact related to functional status. And once you have that, then you have dementia in a bottle. You can measure it, you can get its biomarkers, you can image it, you can do whatever you want, and it's very, very powerful at predicting who has dementia and what stage they're in. So we test that through an analysis called a receiver operating curve, and a perfect test would be 1.0, and D is almost perfect. On the other hand, the rest of the cognitive performance data is not related to dementia at all. And unfortunately, when you look at the test scores, you can't tell which fraction is which. You have to go through all these machinations to dig it out. But only a small sliver of cognitive performance is actually related to functional status, but that sliver represents the dementing process. And we are now able to pull that out of the data, and hopefully this will lead to new diagnostic methods that may allow people to be diagnosed over the phone, for example, from a telephone interview, or possibly even from a blood test. Once we have dementia in a bottle, then we can image it and get its biomarkers. So we've attempted that. And when you image, what we're doing here, this is the parts of the brain whose atrophy is related specifically to D. And when you do that, you find it's, again, the default mode network. So this key network here looks like it is essential to dementia, and the rest of the brain's pathology is inconvenient, but it's not disabling necessarily, and therefore it's not really contributing to the loss of autonomy and independence that we think of as the demented state. So don't get me wrong, Alzheimer's causes trouble all over other parts of the brain, but that pathology is not related to who we would recognize as demented and who isn't. So it turns out that the amyloid, which we can now image, is mapping to the very same network. Look at this. Here's where the amyloid density is the thickest in the brain. Here is the hubs of the default mode network. They're almost identical. So here again, this is the parts of the brain that are related to the default mode network, and here is where the amyloid lives in the brain. So the amyloid that we've been thinking as being a malcontent, a really troublesome partner that does in animals, especially in a lot of the stuff that Dr. Perry has done, is associated with inflammation and oxidative stress and the destruction of neurons. Nonetheless, it is co-localized with the key parts of the brain, and yet persons who exhibit that pathology on their imaging are not demented, even though the lesions are growing in the very neurons that are responsible for dementia. So that makes me have a different feel for what is going on with amyloid. Oops, and I'll show you that in a second, but first I want to show you that D maps to the very same network. Do you see, this is where the atrophy related to my D construct. And here is the amyloid, and here's the default mode network. So when you look at this here, this is a movie of longitudinal data where they're looking at the spread of atrophy over the brain as people go from pre-dementia to dementia over the space of maybe 3 years. And so this was published several years ago. And I want you to see here that the atrophy is going the fastest in parts of the brain that have the least amyloid. And the atrophy is going the slowest in the default mode network's hubs that have the most amyloid. So this makes me think that the amyloid might actually be protective, that it may have a function in the brain. Sure, it kills neurons, but some neurons need to be killed. And maybe they happen to be the ones that are infected by viruses. And you can't let your immune system into the brain because it would turn it to jello. So you need a mechanism that is able to thwart the propagation of a predator through your neural network and yet spare most of the network. Because networks are robust. You know from the real world, your experience with the phone system, that you can knock out half the phones and it'll still keep working. So basically, I'm imagining that amyloid may serve a role, something like that, that it spares neurons that are downstream from the one it kills. And by doing that, keeps as much of the network intact as possible. So here is the state of drug development in Alzheimer's disease. The center here are the drugs that are approved, and right around that are drugs that are recently have been in phase 3 trials, which means they're in the pivotal trials that might lead to improvement. And behind that are drugs that are in phase 2, where you're looking at safety. And behind that are phase 1, where you just want to see if, you know, if it works in animals. And then around these are kind of pie-in-the-sky ideas. So, we've been busy. Everybody's been working on this for, you know, the decade of the brain was in the 1990s. We've been working and working and working, but everything we've tried so far has failed. Everything on the left of this slide is directed against amyloid. And in animal models, they work. But in humans, we haven't had any success so far. And nobody really knows the reason why. But it's very difficult to allow yourself to imagine that maybe it's because our model of amyloid is wrong. So people are generally clutching at other straws. But I think, to me, it's starting to look like there's something wrong with the model. We need a different way to think about Alzheimer's. So, it's not going to be simple, right? No more tangles here. So, you're not going to go soon to the pharmacy and get the elixir of life is going to, keep you young. I'm not holding that card. You can see from my hair here. But I do want to bring your attention to this compound here, rapamycin, which is being extensively studied here in San Antonio at the Barshop Institute, and they have some very exciting results with animals. So they have animal models of Alzheimer's that express amyloid and tangles, and this compound looks like it can prevent the formation of amyloid and even helps amyloid that's already formed if you wait, a long time before you give the medicine. And the amyloid in these animals is related to cognitive impairment, not so much in humans, but in animals it is. And when you give the rapamycin, it improves cognitive performance. So this is a really interesting phenomenon that needs more work. And then finally, TARC has a panel of maybe 150 different biomarkers. And so we're also looking at proteins in the blood that can be related to my D construct for dementia, remember. And we're starting to get some exciting results. So far we found 9 that are related to these D scores, and 8 of those are related to an immunological defense against viruses and other microbial pathogens. So these are all related to this construct of the cognitive correlates of functional status. And then a really interesting thing just sort of popped out that I just want to show you briefly. And one of these proteins is related to platelets. Platelets have an immunological defense mechanism. They participate in the defense of your bloodstream from pathogens like viruses. And when we look at this protein, which predicts D, it's related to D, it looks like there are 2 groups. It doesn't look like just one. It looks like 2. And well, duh, in TARC, we have 2 kinds of people. We have Anglos and Mexican Americans. And so, just on a hunch, I did this analysis, and it turns out that this protein acts very differently across control, mild cognitive impairment, and Alzheimer's, depending on your ethnicity. If you're Anglo, it drops when you become an MCI case and goes back towards normal as you become worse, more demented. But in Hispanics, it's flat. And what that means is that we have effectively a blood test for the earliest stages of Alzheimer's, mild cognitive impairment, but it only works in Anglos. It doesn't work at all with the Mexican-American subjects that are in our cohort. And you can see that in this ROC analysis. Remember, a perfect test is 1.0. This is pretty close, 0.85. It should be a square. It should go straight up and straight over. And you can see it's getting there. But that's only in the Anglos. In Hispanics, it's like flipping a coin. This means it's totally useless. And what that means is that Hispanics must be getting mild cognitive impairment, a precursor to Alzheimer's, through a different biological mechanism. Because these proteins do not even work in Hispanics. And so that's really interesting because modern Mexicans and Mexican Americans are the descendants of huge infectious epidemics in Mexico in the 1500s that killed large fractions of the population. And so the survivors were the ones who went on to have children, and so all current Mexican Americans are descended from this surviving group that was severely challenged in recent historical times by huge epidemics. And so if, in fact, Alzheimer's turns out to have an infectious component, it may be that they've been selected to respond to it in a unique way that's different from the rest of us. And so that might explain why the biological mechanisms that we associate with Alzheimer's in Anglos, a lot of them don't predict in Hispanics very well. So one of our main genetic risks for Alzheimer's is called apolipoprotein E, and that is not such a good risk factor for Alzheimer's in Mexican Americans. So, you know, there's not going to be any easy fixes for Alzheimer's. It's really too challenging a problem. We've been working at this steadily for over a decade now, and we are making progress, but it's very slow, and we're not close to a cure. When someone gets Alzheimer's, you need to realize that it's their executive impairment that disables them, not memory loss. You can't remind someone with Alzheimer's out of their difficulties. They need a mom. Right? They need somebody to manage them, to protect them, to help them. And that's the gold standard, mom. If you're taking care of someone with Alzheimer's, you're essentially cast in the role of mom. And that's the way to understand them is as children, because these critical parts of the brain related to the default mode network are among the last to mature, and kids don't have them fully wired up. So children naturally act like dementia cases, right? And yet, their memory is better than yours, right? So it just shows you that memory loss is not why Alzheimer's patients are demented. They're not demented by memory loss. They're demented by the executive impairment that can be related to the functions of the frontal lobe and this default mode network. So the baby boomers are upon us, you know. We just happen to be at a moment in history where huge numbers of middle-aged persons are entering into their retirement years and are becoming more and more at risk of expressing the stages of Alzheimer's. And we don't have a cure for it yet or a prevention. But there are clues that we could get to something. And I think one of the big clues is that idea of a blockage, a dam. If we could wall Alzheimer's off in the memory centers and not let it get out past that, then the default mode network would be spared, and the patients would not develop what we recognize as dementia, right? So that's something that would be interesting to look into. The state of Texas is responding to this challenge by supporting Alzheimer's research. That's unique in the United States. Other states have talked about something like that, but we've actually implemented it, and that project is going forward. And I think it's capable of generating some really interesting ideas and research findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Royal and Dr. Perry. And we're going to open this up for a question and answer session. And I'm actually going to invite Dr. Perry and Dr. Royal up. And I'm going to pose a couple of questions that I think might be common after having heard this talk. Now, what I was going to ask beforehand was, my mother seems to be forgetting things, but as I understand what you're saying, Dr. Perry, it's really not, that's not what I should be worried about. It might be maybe I notice her having loss in her executive function.
Yep, but so, you know, everybody talks about Alzheimer's as a memory disorder, and it's inevitable that Alzheimer's patients have memory impairment if they become disabled. So memory is a predictor, memory function is a predictor of future dementia, and it's something to worry about. But it's not the memory loss itself that causes the disability or the dementia, and so we generally think of that as what's called mild cognitive impairment. If you have mild cognitive impairment, there's no disability yet. And yet, those memory impairments that are detectable with screening greatly increase the risk of near-term conversion to dementia in the next 3 to 5 years, say.
And I know that, you know, we've said several times there is no cure, but is there any, besides the moderate lifestyle, which I don't want to underestimate, but are there any other ways to delay the onset of Alzheimer's?
Do you have a better one than lifestyle?
I think, you know, practically, on the one hand, no, once this gets started, we don't have a way to slow it down or to stop it. But on the other hand, I don't think it's always started. So the early stages, like I said, the non-dementing stages are endemic. They're very, very common. And their presence in and of itself doesn't necessarily pose a threat. And so what I think happens is a lot of patients develop dementia through executive impairment, and the executive impairment came from a second disease process, not necessarily plaques and tangles. So many people who, you know, very few brains at autopsy only have one disease, right? A lot of them also had strokes, and there's some Lewy bodies thrown in there. And once you start to look at it as a key location, then the key question is, are there plaques and tangles in the default mode network yet? And often the answer to that is no. Instead, what there are strokes in parts of the brain related to executive function, and depression especially. And depression is something we know how to fix. I mean, we have treatments for that. So ironically, one of the most effective ways to delay or prevent conversion to dementia from MCI may actually be to address depression instead. And I think that gets missed, because wouldn't you be depressed if you had MCI and were, you know, just being told that you're going to get dementia in the future? But it turns out that depression can be localized to the very same default mode network. And so the key network is dysfunctional in depressed persons. And so I think what happens is a lot of clinicians and family members believe that Alzheimer's disease is the sole cause of a person's dementia, when actually it may be a mixed state. And that's where we make the biggest clinical gains, I would say, is recognizing mixed states and disentangling them and fixing what we can while we wait for research to tell us how to fix what remains.
And that's where a good clinical evaluation is critical, to be able to diagnose Alzheimer's disease from dementia, from depression, and all of the risks associated with it, and things that psychiatrists can actually make a difference for. Many people are aged have depression symptoms for a lot of reasons beyond Alzheimer's.
Well, I'd like to open it up to your questions. We have two mics up here, if you'd like to make your way to the front. And I know you have lots and lots of questions tonight, so we will try to ask everybody to just keep it to one question, if that's possible. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. How do you explain that when a long-term Alzheimer's patient, and in my mother's case, 12 years, and for 5-6 years, no recognition at all, no obvious recognition of me, 10 days before she dies, actually interacts with me in a conversation?
That would be better for a psychiatrist.
I'm puzzled, because there was absolutely no obvious recognition of who I was.
Let me ask you, though, when you say she interacts with you, were you saying she recognized you then?
I believe. She was hospitalized.
Yeah.
You know, for 3 days I went under oxygen, no movement.
Yeah.
The fourth day they said, your mother was naughty today. What do you mean? She spit her food. My mother was very much a lady, never did that. Spit her food, pulled out the IVs, hit the nurses, all of these awful things. So when I went in, she looked at me, and I can't tell you except that it was a different look. And I said, Mother, are you tired of all of this? With her eyes. And then I said, do you want me to have it taken away? Uh-huh. I said, do you want to go be with Daddy? Uh-huh.
Right.
And then no other recognition. And that was always puzzling to me.
Yeah.
That happened, and like I said, for years and years.
Right.
No obvious recognition when I went into the room or anything.
Yeah. Well, so
what happens in the brain that allows that to happen?
Well, as far as recognition goes, you know, Alzheimer's, classical Alzheimer's, is starting in your nose and eating its way back. The very last parts of the brain to succumb are visual recognition centers. Mm-hmm. And so it's usually a late finding in Alzheimer's to not recognize family members or loved ones or yourself in a mirror, because they're probably getting these visual impairments, and the lines and the shadows just don't add up to you anymore.
Right.
You know, it's also common by that stage, they've already got language impairment, and so they can't really talk and describe, you know, what's going on with them anymore. So nursing home residents can get to that point. It's been described, though, that shortly before death, there is a great kind of autonomic surge, you know, as the body resists. Usually pneumonia is one of the things that kill Alzheimer's patients in nursing homes towards the end.
Yeah.
And I've seen case reports of people who are in a coma and mute for years, suddenly just wake up and have conversations with people and then die very shortly afterwards, and they think it's the autonomic stress, you know, the stress of fighting the disease, and as the body gets desperate, it just throws everything it's got left, and people just can wake up in that final moment and are amazingly lucid.
Well, thank you. I viewed it as a gift. But I always wondered what happened in the brain that would allow for that.
Yeah.
You know, and then she died 10 days later. Okay. Thank you so much.
There's a widespread belief in the natural foods community that Alzheimer's is related to the uptake of aluminum, specifically from aluminum cookingware, baking with aluminum foil, and the use of aluminum in deodorants. Do you know of any scientific evidence regarding that?
That's still an active area of study. People looking at aluminum and Alzheimer's disease is not one of the biggest growing areas. There are less investigators now than there were in 1985. Most of the people that study the aluminum approach to disease have converted to looking at other metals, particularly copper and iron. And in fact, there's a drug that's undergoing phase 2 plus trials right now, looking at copper chelation. One of the most recent tests of alumina idea was to actually lower people's aluminum levels in the body using silicone-rich water. And it showed some health benefits, mild. The problem with testing the aluminum idea is aluminum is the most common metal in our environment. It's the most common metal. It's the third most common element. Third most common element in the Earth's crust. It's impossible to avoid aluminum. It isn't just deodorants. And so it goes to the body. It has no known biological function. And it attaches to plaques and tangles. But that's true of everybody, that there's this aluminum. And it does have toxicity, but it's never been well correlated.
Of all of the potential treatments for Alzheimer's, which groups of people have these been tested on? For example, are they being tested on people who already have Alzheimer's in various stages, or have there been any attempts at preventative treatments tested on people who do not yet have Alzheimer's? Or
do you want to comment on that?
Well, you know, most studies are done on dementia cases, especially early in the drug's development. Once the drug is approved, then sort of other studies usually get done in other conditions. And so there have been studies in mild cognitive impairment to see if the approved drugs can slow or prevent conversion to dementia in the future. And so far, all of those have been negative.
And doing trials which are now invoked for looking at amyloid at earlier phases, these trials are very expensive and very hard to do. Because the conversion rate, say if you were to look at the 60-year-old person that has amyloid in the brain, their conversion to becoming demented is very low for a single year. So you'd have to look at thousands and thousands of patients. And that's already been a problem. The clinical trials of Alzheimer's disease have been estimated to cost over $4 billion, not paid by government, paid by drug companies, and whether they're willing to undertake those kind of studies is still unclear.
Hi. Rudy wanted you to talk about aluminum. I would like for you to talk about any effect that mercury has in this.
You know, any...
Mercury is clearly a neurotoxin. There's been some work out of our medical school on mercury as an environmental cause possibly for autism. It's not the same as Alzheimer's, but in the sort of ballpark. I don't know of any specifically in Alzheimer's disease.
It doesn't help cause those tangles?
I can comment a little bit. That the biggest exposure, the issue for adults, is amalgams. You know, we are frightened if a thermometer breaks on the ground, but dentists put silver mercury alloys in our mouth. And the mercury from that can leach into your body. It's not as toxic as organomercuries, mercury compounds that are actually, frankly, poisonous. So there were studies done by the same people who did the aluminum looking whether they could understand people if they removed amalgams, et cetera. There was no obvious correlation. And it was done also in the nun study, which is a well-controlled study of Catholic religious women. They looked at those that had fillings versus not. There was no obvious correlation.
Thank you.
Have you looked at regions and populations who have different rates from what you're seeing in what you posted for us, for example? In other words, New Zealand or Chile or groups that are not necessarily industrialized in any way. Is there any evidence that there's a difference in their rates of change or increasing of Alzheimer's incidence around the world? Both either way, because ones that were not industrialized now are, you can look at those populations and vice versa.
The rates of Alzheimer's disease are thought to be pretty much the same all over the world. That's not necessarily addressing Hispanic populations. The rates of dementia are pretty high in Hispanics, but it hasn't. Most of those are epidemiological studies, so they can't really conclusively prove that dementia is due to Alzheimer's.
So in New Zealand, for example, it's the same rates.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Thank you.
The biggest risk for having Alzheimer's disease in most of the population is living to advanced age. So in a lot of non-industrialized places, people die younger, and that lowers their rate.
Hello. What are your thoughts about coconut oil that I've been reading on the internet and at health stores about possibly preventing Alzheimer's and maybe even reversing Alzheimer's?
I don't think it's been shown by any clinically valid study so far. It's mostly in the popular press and those selling on the internet.
But no studies are being done around coconut oil?
I don't know of any. I looked at that about 2 months ago because someone from CNN called me and wanted me to talk about it, and I then looked about it. I do think it's interesting to look at a ketogenic diet, maybe having some protective role. Certainly, there's a lot of indications a diet that's rich in sugars and carbohydrates has some detrimental effect, but I'm not going to... say that everybody should have coconut oil either.
It's not been validated. I was just wondering if there's been any studies. Okay. Yes, I'm interested in the cognitive, or I shouldn't say cognitive, in the assessment that you can do bedside that you mentioned or was mentioned in the introduction.
Yeah, I didn't talk about that, but basically we've developed some bedside tests of executive function. So a lot of cognitive testing was... didn't really accommodate executive impairment. When I trained, no one even talked about executive function in dementia assessment or in the context of Alzheimer's disease. So we set out to build some tests of that, and we've developed and published two of them, one called CLOCKS. It's related to clock drawing, and the other one's called the executive interview. And they're actually better than average as predictors of functional status, and what you find is a lot of persons have executive impairment and they don't have any memory loss. And it challenges the idea that memory is essential to dementia case finding. So I think if you screen for dementia with a memory test, the only patients you'll find are Alzheimer's cases, and you'll convince yourself Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia. But if you screen with executive tests, then you'll find that many other people we don't think of as having dementia, have a disabling cognitive impairment, executive impairment, and it's just that they don't have Alzheimer's. So causes of that kind of presentation are a lot of the subcortical strokes, major depression, diabetes is associated with executive impairment. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people who have the same disability and executive impairment as Alzheimer's cases, but they're not recognized because they pass traditional Alzheimer's screening tests, mm-hmm. Which are insensitive to executive function.
And are these under your name if I look them up?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I know we could go until midnight because this is an inexhaustible subject, but we do need to close tonight. And can we give Drs. Royal and Perry a wonderful thank you? And we look forward to seeing you in October. Have a great night.
Great. Get that one over.
Okay.